Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Dawn Kernagis, and today we have Dr. Richard Moon here with us. Also joining us is Dr. Ken Forge, IHMC's director and CEO.
Hello, Dawn. Good to be here with you today. Today's guest, Richard Moon, was yet another unanimous selection of the Double Secret Selection Committee.
Richard Moon is a world-renowned physician and researcher who works in hyperbaric and diving medicine.
Dawn, I understand that Dr. Moon has been a mentor to you. Can you tell us how you met?
Yeah, absolutely. I was very lucky to have Dr. Moon as a mentor. We actually met when I was a diver, and I participated in some of his research projects at Duke University. And from that point on, I went to him with some research ideas, and he accepted me as a grad student and has been a mentor and colleague ever since.
Before we get to the interview today, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and especially appreciate all the wonderful 5-star reviews absolutely piling up on iTunes.
And as we announced in several earlier episodes, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing the iTunes reviews with an eye toward selecting the best reviews to read on STEM Talk. There are extra points for pithiness, wit, and of course, lavish praise.
If you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt. Today, our winning 5-star review was posted by someone operating under the moniker GTG2010. As soon as we hear from GTG2010, a STEM Talk t-shirt will be on the way. Quite appropriately, the review is titled Exploding Kid.
Here is a winning 5-star review.
Dear STEM Talk, I like your show. The super telescope looking at asteroids is cool. I like it so much, I'm going to explode. Love, Griffin, age 6.
That's awesome.
Very cool.
Thank you, GTG2010, and the thousands of other STEM Talk listeners who have helped make STEM Talk a great success right out of the gate.
And now, on to Dawn's interview with Dr. Richard Moon.
Dr. Richard Moon is a professor of anesthesiology, pulmonary, and critical care medicine at Duke University. He is also the medical director for the Center of the Hyperbaric Medicine and Environmental Physiology Laboratory at Duke University Medical Center. Richard Moon has his MD and CM degrees from McGill University in Montreal, Canada, and a master's degree in biomedical engineering from the University of Toronto in Toronto, Canada. He holds certifications in internal medicine, pulmonary diseases, and anesthesia from the Royal College of Physicians of Canada, American Board of Internal Medicine, American Board of Pulmonary Diseases, American Board of Anesthesiology, and American Board of Internal Medicine and Critical Care Medicine, and undersea and hyperbaric medicine from the American Board of Preventive Medicine. He has received numerous awards and special recognitions as a researcher, clinician, and educator. He is a world-renowned researcher in anesthesiology, pulmonary, undersea, environmental, and hyperbaric medicine, and has authored hundreds of peer-reviewed publications on both clinical and research topics in these areas.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
Today we have with us Dr. Richard Moon. Richard, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So just to get started, you've had this illustrious career, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in the podcast. How did you first become interested in science and medicine?
I think when I was in high school, I used to watch all of the medical shows. There was one called Medicine in the 60s that actually showed operations. This is on black and white TV, so you can imagine how it wasn't very impressive compared with what might be available today, but to me it was absolutely mind-blowing. And so I decided that I had to go into medicine, and the rest of my high school and college career basically was aiming toward that goal.
And did you know that you wanted to go into anesthesia and pulmonary medicine, or how did you figure that out?
Pulmonary medicine was fairly easy because in first year medical school, we had a series of lectures based on organ systems. It was very traditional, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And the very best series was the pulmonary one. There were a number of leading pulmonary investigators at the time, and these guys were absolutely phenomenal. And so pulmonary was in the back of my mind throughout the rest of medical school and medical residency, although I hadn't really made any decisions. I did an internal medicine residency, and but I knew I wanted to do something different. So I took a couple of years off to study bioengineering. And along the way, I had become interested in diving. The physiology of diving to me was intrinsically very interesting, although I knew hardly anything about it. And so toward the end of my internal medicine training, I started looking around and went to visit University of Pennsylvania, that was a leading institution in diving physiology and medicine at the time. I also came to Duke and spoke with people like Drs. Herb Saltzman, John Salzano, Enrico Camporisi, and these were actually pulmonary investigators. So when it came time to figure out exactly where I was going to go, it was very intriguing to come to Duke, because they offered me not only scientific training in diving physiology, but also a pulmonary medicine fellowship. And so I did that. But one of my mentors, Enrico Camporisi, was an anesthesiologist. There were actually four people in our little group that were interested studying the lung. There was John Salzano, who was the senior man, and Enrico Camporisi was also a faculty member.
Mm-hmm.
Enrico was an anesthesiologist, and he started working on me almost right away, saying, well, pulmonary medicine is fine, but anesthesia is a lot more interesting. But I didn't really have any interest in doing any more clinical training above and beyond what I already had or was in the process of doing. But eventually he won me over, and I thought, well, if I do an anesthesia residency, then it will probably help my pulmonary career at the very least. And so that's what I ended up doing. And of course, I found it, you know, as he said, it was very interesting in and of itself. And that's where I am today.
You said that your interest in diving medicine and diving physiology was piqued. What was it that got your interest or caught your interest in diving physiology?
Probably initially it was a very dumb reason, like the program Sea Hunt, you know, that probably most of the listeners won't even know what it is. But around that time or sometime afterwards, Jacques Cousteau started doing his programs, and that was interesting. And I read all of Jacques Cousteau's books,
mm-hmm.
and there was some diving physiology in there, in the sense that they talked about decompression sickness and thermal issues and carbon monoxide poisoning of the breathing gas and that kind of thing. So I was interested in it. And, you know, when it came time to actually figure out where I was going to go after internal medicine, since Duke had this mega lab, arguably the best in the world, mm-hmm. and some leading lights in diving physiology, I just couldn't resist.
Yeah, it's an opportunity of a lifetime. And you just go to this lab. So the F.G. Hall Center for Hyperbaric Medicine and Environmental Physiology is considered to be one of the most prestigious environmental physiology labs in the world. And especially back then, there was some research that was being done that, you know, wasn't being done anywhere else and hasn't been done anywhere else in the world. So can you talk a little bit about the history of the laboratory?
Yes, the lab actually has an interesting history. One of the questions I often get is, how did this undersea lab ever get to be in a place that isn't near the ocean? And I wasn't around at the time that the lab was put together, but there was a confluence of interests at Duke University at the time. Herb Saltzman was a pulmonologist who was interested in diving, And F.G. Hall, of course, had been, he was a former, earlier generation, although I think he was around a little bit at the time. He'd been interested in altitude physiology. And then there was a surgeon named Ivan Brown who was interested in cardiac surgery under hyperbaric conditions. Hmm. And this was an era before cardiopulmonary bypass, heart-lung machines were developed. And so the notion of sort of drenching the tissues with oxygen at the time, as it was called, was very appealing. If you could hyperoxygenate tissues in a hyperbaric chamber during surgery, then you would have longer, let me just back up a minute. In order to perform surgery at the time, you had to clamp the aorta. Mm-hmm. Essentially, you had to either substantially slow or absolutely stop blood flow for a brief period of time to allow the surgeon enough time to do what he wanted to do on the heart. And then hopefully the brain and other organs wouldn't be too badly affected. That was the idea. But if you hyperoxygenated the brain and other tissues, then presumably you'd have longer available time. And so one of the chambers that in the Duke complex was actually built as a hyperbaric operating room. Hmm. It wasn't a new idea because it had been pursued actually at the University of Amsterdam and also at Harvard to some extent. So, but anyway, Dr. Brown was interested in doing this, and so the enough money was put together to put together the facility. So there was the diving aspect, the hyperbaric surgery aspect, and the altitude part of it all in one facility. By the time the chamber was open, heart-lung machines were already being developed or were in place, and so the whole concept was out of date. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, it was a very nice, roomy facility with which to treat patients and do other things as well. And then, as it turned out, as soon as the chamber, 1968, when the chamber was opened, there was a nuclear submarine disaster, and the Navy realized they didn't have the facility to do deep diving. And so Dr. Saltzman was asked to initiate a deep diving program to develop the capability of having deep rescue or salvage operations at 1,000 feet of seawater. Mm-hmm. So that's how it all started. But again, that was before I got there.
And that was the Atlantis series?
No, the Atlantis series were actually later. So okay. the in the late 60s, mid 70s, and so on, there was perceived to be a world shortage of oil, and so oil exploration on the continental shelf started. And the continental shelf is quite deep, and commercial diving did not have the capability to dive deep beyond a few hundred feet. Mm-hmm. And even at that, it was a bit of a stretch. And so actually several labs around the world, in the United States, there was University of Pennsylvania at Duke. There was a lab in Europe that was doing it. There was a lab in Japan to study the physiology of humans during deep, greater than 1,000 feet, potentially up to 2,000 feet, human exposure to those kinds of depths. And there are several problems associated with that. One is something called high-pressure nervous syndrome, which mm-hmm. is a condition where the diver gets tremors, has difficulty standing up, maintaining balance, and also nausea and vomiting. That's HPNS. And HPNS was not... the physiology is still not understood, but it was felt to be perhaps due to the helium or perhaps due to the pressure. And so part of the Duke endeavor, which became known as the Atlantis dive series, was to work out how this could be overcome. And one idea that was held by Dr. Peter Bennett, who was the director of the lab at the time, was to put a little bit of narcotic gas in the breathing mix, between 5 and 10% nitrogen, mm-hmm. that was felt might offset HPNS. The long story short is that it did work to a large extent, but of course it had other effects, such as an increase in gas density. And that's where the four of us, Dr. Salzano and Camparisi, Brett Stulp, who then went to medical school, is now on the Duke faculty, and myself as a pulmonary fellow, were involved. And the question we were trying to address was, when with this increase in gas density that was occurred because of not only the high pressure but also the addition of nitrogen, did the lung actually work to provide enough oxygen to the blood and to remove carbon dioxide? Mm-hmm. And so we did experiments, actually, and we were the first and actually the only group ever to measure blood gases, that is the arterial blood CO2, carbon dioxide, and oxygen, and also pH, under those conditions. And what we found was that the lung actually worked pretty well, contrary to what was believed at the time, and nevertheless not perfectly. And so we basically we provided the boundaries on what the lung could do under those circumstances.
That's fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about the experimental setup? Because, you know, I've seen the pictures, and anybody who's had the opportunity to take a tour of the Duke Hyperbaric Chamber or even look through the history of the Duke Hyperbaric Center can see pictures of some of these experimental exposures. But can you kind of describe that for our listeners?
Yes. First of all, in order to get to 2,000 feet, it takes several days. So one mechanism of offsetting HPNS is to add a little bit of nitrogen to the mix, and we did that. But that doesn't solve the problem entirely.
Right.
The rest of the problem can be addressed by compressing slowly. So it takes about a week or so to get from the surface to a depth in a hyperbaric chamber by steadily increasing the pressure in stages to 2,000 feet. Ultimately, we reached the depth of 2,250 feet. And of course, it takes 2 to 3 weeks to get the people inside out because right. of decompression issues. So those it was three guys. We did four experiments, each one of which had three individuals inside. So they're stuck inside. If one of them had developed an acute illness, let's say appendicitis, it would have taken 3 weeks to get them out.
Right.
And so, and of course, they're in very tight quarters. They were in a small 8-foot diameter steel ball with, there was a downstairs, yes, but it was nevertheless very tight. In order for them to sleep, we had to lock in bunks that were arranged in layers. And in the middle of the night, if somebody had to get up to go to the bathroom, everybody had to wake up. The bunks had to be taken apart so that he could go downstairs and do his thing. Food had to be locked in and everything. All the refreshments, of course, had to be locked in, and waste had to be locked out. The experiment was actually, our part of the experiment was to have each person exercise on an exercise bicycle. But before doing that, the other two guys had to place an arterial catheter in one of the arteries in the wrist. And of course, to do that, they had to be trained. And you can look from the outside and see what they're doing, but you obviously can't reach in and help.
Right.
Nevertheless, they were able to do the task, and we were able to get arterial blood. And actually, that's only half the story. The other half is it has to be analyzed on a blood gas machine that is not exactly designed for use at 2,000 feet. So it was an adventure in not only biology but also engineering. And I was just blown away by being able to take part in all that.
It's like it's remote medicine. It's like telemedicine, even though it's right there in front of you. There's not much that you can do hands-on. You
have Absolutely,
to
yes.
guide them through everything. It's really interesting. Yes. Psychologically, how did the participants, I can only imagine being locked into a chamber with two other people and then quarters that are that tight, undergoing that kind of exposure might lend to some psychological issues? Were there any over the course of the Atlantis Dive series?
Oh yes, of course. If you're locked into any room with any other two people, of course there are areas of friction and you know, how's the food and various other things. Mm-hmm. Three is arguably worse than two or four because one of the individuals is always the fall guy. I say guy because they were all guys, but it was a challenge. Nevertheless, they were carefully chosen and they were up to it and ultimately did a great job.
Yeah, it was really interesting. And we're going to put a link up to the Hyperbaric Center website on our podcast page so that people can take a look and see a little bit more information about the F.G. Hall Center. So kind of moving on from that, there have been just numerous projects that have been conducted for the Navy and NASA and other entities with respect to kind of extreme environmental exposures and how the human body responds to those exposures. Can you talk a little bit about some other projects that are ongoing right now at the Hyperbaric Center?
Yes. One of the benefits of the chamber at Duke is that it's actually within a hospital. And so we can expose people to either high pressure or low pressure to simulate altitude and have all of the accoutrements of medicine available. So we've been able to do some very interesting studies. One study that we've been doing recently is actually being run by Dr. Jake Freiberger, and he's been interested in looking at nitrogen narcosis and whether there is an additional narcotic effect or cognitive effect of additional carbon dioxide. I need to back up a little bit to say that in diving, particularly in Navy diving, where divers may be exerting themselves very heavily, carbon dioxide levels in the blood tend to be elevated above normal.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, if a diver is using a closed circuit breathing rig, in other words, requiring carbon dioxide absorbent, the CO2 absorbent might not always be working perfectly. And so there may be actually some increase in inspired carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
And Jake is, I can't give you the results now because I don't know them, but he's working on the analysis right now to see what the pattern is. We've also been investigating a condition called immersion pulmonary edema, which is was discovered back in the 1980s. It's essentially been called drowning from the inside, where individuals, divers or swimmers, lungs fill up with fluid. And it's been a very mysterious condition. And what we've shown by actually measuring pressures in the pulmonary artery by using special catheters, we've shown that people who are susceptible to immersion pulmonary edema have higher pressures for a given amount of exercise than people who are not susceptible to it. It reached the public's, if you like, consciousness because Navy SEALs, not only in the U.S. Navy, but also special forces in other navies, have experienced this. And these are, we're not talking about, people with bad hearts. These
right.
are very young, healthy, exceptionally fit individuals who start coughing up fluid and blood in the middle of what would otherwise be a normal swim. And so we think we understand now what causes it. And we may have some suggestions as to, you know, how this may be dealt with in the future, prevented.
What are the thoughts behind what causes immersion pulmonary edema in kind of layman's terms?
Yeah, well, we think it's because the hearts of people who are susceptible to immersion pulmonary edema are normal, mm-hmm. often normal, although sometimes in the older population they aren't. But in the young population who get this, they're normal, but they're just a little bit different in the sense that they, when the heart fills up with blood, remember, of course, we always think of the heart as contracting and squeezing blood out, but it also has to fill.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that the properties of the heart when it fills are a little bit different in people who are susceptible to immersion pulmonary edema, in that their left heart, their left ventricle, is a little stiffer than normal, and still normal, but a little stiffer than, should we say, the non-susceptible population.
Right.
And therefore, in order to fill it, the pressure is a little bit higher. And adding to that extreme exertion, that raises the pressure even higher.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's enough to break the barrier between the blood on the within the lung and the air spaces within the lung, and, and actually cause fluid to leak.
Interesting. So, and you said that you think you found ways to address this now.
Yes. One thing we found is that a lot of people, including the Navy, are very have recommended pushing fluids, as to say, dehydration is a bad thing, which we know it is. If you're if you're anybody exercising, you don't want to be dehydrated, and so overloading with fluid actually tends to make the problem worse. There are also some potential drugs that can be taken that affect the relaxation of blood vessels that can reduce the pressure and eliminate, well, should we say, reduce the risk of it.
Well, that's really important for people, especially those who have experienced it. I'm sure it's life-changing if they know that they can get in the water and swim and not have to be concerned necessarily about development of pulmonary edema.
That's right. And actually, it's, Navy SEALs tend to get it, but also there's a subset of people who engage in triathlons who who get it during the swim portion of the race. And we've seen a lot of, we've evaluated a lot of individuals who've gotten this repetitively. And, you know, triathletes are really go-go kind of people, and they want to win the race. And they often see it as not a health problem that has to be dealt with, but rather something that got them out of the race that they were preparing for or slows them down. And so we've been working with many of those individuals as well.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
So you've talked a lot about the work that you've done with immersion physiology, and you've done extensive research in the diving realm, but you've also done a lot of research with respect to high altitude and hypobaric conditions. And I know that some of the work that you've been doing actually took you on an expedition to Mount Everest. Can you talk a little bit about some of the field research that you did there?
Yes. The problem with altitude is basically boils down to one thing, and that is low levels of oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
The percentage of oxygen in the atmosphere at high altitude is exactly the same as the percentage here at sea level, but the because the pressure is lower, the partial pressure, as we call it, of oxygen at altitude is lower as well. And low oxygen has some a variety of effects on human physiology. And for example, people who go to altitude, even moderate altitude, often experience something called acute mountain sickness, which is headache, nausea, vomiting, not feeling well. And we don't know what causes it. We do know that over time, this usually goes away over 3, 4, 5, 10 days. And after that period of time, there's been adaptation. It can also cause two rarer conditions. One is called high-altitude cerebral edema, where the brain swells up, and another one where the lungs actually fill up with fluid, very similar in some ways to immersion pulmonary edema. We have a very poor understanding of all three conditions. But in terms of normal physiology, if anybody is amongst the listeners has been to altitude, they'll know exactly what I'm talking about. But if you go to, say, 10,000 feet and then you do something that would be completely within your capability at sea level, such as, you know, jog, you realize that at altitude you really can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You get short of breath and you have to stop. One of the mysteries of altitude is there are people who have lived at altitude for tens of thousands of years, such as the Sherpas. Mm-hmm. And on our trek to Mount Everest, we were continually passed by these Sherpa carriers who would have up to 80 kilos, I'm not kidding, 80 kilograms on their back. And they'd be blasting past us like, you know, we were standing still. How can they do that? And these are not large people. These are, you know, small guys. They're typically, they weigh 140, 150 pounds at the most, and they're carrying something that's much greater than their own weight. And how did we do? One of the pieces of information we were able to glean from that was obtained by putting pulse oximeters on ourselves. We had about nine people in our group who had continuous monitoring of pulse oximetry, which is something that everyone gets in the doctor's office. You put your finger in the thing and it reads 98 or 99%. Mm-hmm. And in medicine, we get terribly nervous when somebody's oxygen level goes below, say, 90%. Mm-hmm. In anesthesia, which I practice, you know, we go into panic mode when that happens. But surprisingly, what we found was on the way to Mount Everest, we were starting off in the 70s when we landed on our plane at Lukla Airport, and then over you know the next 10 days on the way to the summit, we were often down in the 60s, and and yet if you ask even the average physician what would happen if someone's oxygen saturation drops into the 60s? They say, well, brain damage, of course. Well, as far as I know, none of my colleagues or I developed any brain damage. And so how could this possibly be? And so it's difficult to do field research because although you have the environment and you can go to these ridiculous altitudes, when I say ridiculous, I mean altitudes to which a human experimentation committee wouldn't let you go.
Right.
On the other hand, you can't do things under those conditions that you could do in a lab-based facility. So it's always a balance, and you get incremental pieces of information from each type of research.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talked about the lab-based hypobaric conditions. You know, the Environmental Physiology Research Center has those capabilities as well. And so you guys have done extensive high-altitude research at the chamber. Can you talk a little bit about some of the projects that you've worked on with respect to hypoxia and high-altitude performance?
Yes. We recently finished a study, and this was actually propelled by a medical student, John Andrews, who was a Green Beret before he went to medical school. He's having personally experienced altitude himself, was very interested in doing a project. And we studied a new drug called Reosiguat, which is marketed as a prescription drug for people who have a condition called pulmonary hypertension. Mm-hmm. And it works in a new way that other drugs that are currently on the market did not property that they didn't have. So we were interested in knowing whether this drug would increase exercise performance at altitude. And by way of background, I can tell you that at altitude in hypoxia, the blood vessels that perfuse the lung constrict. They become smaller, and therefore the pressure inside the pulmonary artery that feeds the lungs goes up. And we were interested in knowing that if we brought the pressure down with this new drug, would that improve exercise performance, or would it improve oxygenation? Would the oxygen levels go up? What we found was that, indeed, pulmonary artery pressure did come down. The drug worked as advertised. But unfortunately, it didn't change exercise performance, and it didn't improve oxygenation. So it was a negative study, but an important one, because had it worked, actually, this could have been a very useful drug for, let's say, special forces were, you know, deployed in the mountainous areas of the world that would need every ounce of performance improvement they could get.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's so much interesting research going on there. So, and not just with respect to diving and high altitude exposure, but also with respect to hyperbaric oxygen therapy. Can you talk about some of the latest and greatest in the area of hyperbaric oxygen therapy research?
Well, hyperbaric oxygen is something that goes back quite a long way. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially a dive in a hyperbaric chamber breathing 100% oxygen. So our chamber typically exposes people to two atmospheres pressure, or double atmospheric pressure, breathing 100% oxygen. This has some very interesting therapeutic effects. One is that it's been useful for, known to be useful for diving injuries, for decompression sickness for a long time. Mm-hmm. But it's also used for other emergencies, such as carbon monoxide poisoning. And you can wake people up with hyperbaric oxygen more quickly. If they're poisoned with carbon monoxide, you can prevent long-term complications, or at least reduce the risk of long-term complications. Mm-hmm. And people feel better very quickly. A third example of an emergency is something called necrotizing fasciitis, or gas gangrene. It's an infection of the soft tissues that occurs with specific types of bacteria that is highly lethal. It's often 100% lethal without appropriate treatment. Mm-hmm. And hyperbaric oxygen facilitates the killing of those particular types of organisms. But it's also used on a repetitive basis for a healing of certain types of wounds, largely in individuals who have reduced blood supply. So mm-hmm. People who have atherosclerosis or diabetes and they develop foot wounds, they often don't heal very well, and so hyperbaric oxygen can accelerate that. So those are a few conditions where hyperbaric oxygen can be helpful.
So it sounds like the chamber stays fairly busy between the experimental projects and clinical treatment protocol that you have running on a regular basis.
It does indeed.
Yeah. So you've had this very unique career. You identified that you were interested in medicine, you went that route, and that you were interested in diving physiology. And so you found a way to make that happen, which is a fairly unique field to go into. What kind of advice would you have for somebody who is young and wants to go into a field like diving medicine or high altitude medicine or something that's so unique?
For high altitude medicine, there are several routes. Expeditionary medicine in the armed forces is one possibility. Mm-hmm. Both in diving and in altitude medicine, one particular, should we say, career path is to go into a related field. And it could be surgery, it could be internal medicine, it could be pulmonary medicine, anesthesia, any real career that deals with acutely ill patients, and use diving medicine or altitude medicine as a sideline. So be available, get training in, and make oneself available for fitness to climb or fitness to dive evaluations. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of interest in having lectures to the local dive club, for example. Mm-hmm. To do it full time, you have to really pursue it. One way would be to affiliate or go to a place like Duke or University of Pennsylvania that has a facility that's doing that sort of thing, or join the military. Yeah. And there are jobs, of course, in the military in diving medicine, because diving, is part bread and butter, Navy as well as Army.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of overlapping research between all those centers, as you discussed, and not just the academic centers, but also the military research centers. There's a lot of tie between all of those laboratories. So,
yeah,
it's a really interesting field. So as far as books, I've been into your office, I've seen your library, and I'm sure that's just a small collection of the books that you've collected over the years. What have there been any books that were specifically influential with respect to your career in medicine or as a researcher or just in general as a person?
I would say that to learn about the diving experience or the altitude experience, I've read a lot of books written by people who've, for example, Jacques Cousteau, or many of the mountaineers, the well-known ones whose stories have always fascinated me and still fascinate me. In terms of the medicine of diving, I think the book that really got me into it was edited by Peter Bennett and David Elliott. It's a classic, Bennett and Elliott's Diving Medicine. But there are several others. Fred Bove has edited a book for several editions. So those books are absolutely classic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great advice. I'm going to go back to the Everest expedition because most people, probably most of our listeners, have not had the chance to experience Mount Everest. What was your first impression when you, I mean, I'm sure you see it from a long ways away. I don't really know. Can you describe the trek into base camp and what that was like?
Yes, the earliest expeditions, the Hillary expedition, they had to walk from Kathmandu, and it takes a couple of weeks to reach the start-off point, which is a little town called Lukla. Most people now fly into Lukla from Kathmandu, and Lukla has, by the way, the most dangerous airport in the world. And when you get there, you realize the approach to the airport as well as the landing itself is it doesn't give the pilot any second chance. You got to get it just right.
Is that because of where it's located within the mountains? Or okay?
Yes. Okay. So it's you're flying in with what appear your wingtips are close to mountains, and then the runway itself is it goes cliff runway cliff, and so you have this little landing strip. There's no way to turn the aircraft around if you miss the landing. But Lukla is about 10,000 feet. So the altitude is not exceptional in terms of where you're actually going. Mm-hmm. And you get out of the airplane, you don't really feel anything. You're almost in shirt sleeves. It's relatively warm. And then you start walking and you realize this is not going to be an ordinary hike.
Yeah.
The first day, you have to go down almost 1,000 feet along the trail, and then you have to go back up 1,000 feet, and you realize after this slog, you aren't any further ahead than you were at the beginning. And I have to say that my own experience was at the end of that day, I thought, if this continues like this, I don't think I'm going to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
For the next 10 days, it's progressively more spectacular. The scenery is absolutely out of this world. It starts off as almost tropical, not exactly tropical, but temperate, very leafy, trees, bushes. It's almost like a hike you could make in a U.S. national park.
Mm-hmm.
And then the higher you go, eventually it becomes barren as the trees drop away, and then eventually it's snow and ice.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you get to base camp, base camp is, of course, it's basically parked right on the edge of a glacier, and it's totally snow. But it also has a huge diurnal variation in temperature. When you wake up in the morning, you've gone through at night, minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit, and then by lunchtime, you're sitting, again, almost in, not quite in shirt sleeves, but with very little clothing on, sort of basking in the sun. But once the sun goes down behind the mountain, it becomes very cold again. The other interesting thing is the Sherpas are absolutely delightful people.
Mm-hmm.
You stop in at these guest houses along the way, and you spend the night, and there's usually one room only that is warm. There's a stove in the middle, which is burning. There's no wood. They burn yak dung, and the food is pretty good. But despite eating like crazy along the way, because you're hiking and it's hard work, we all lost weight. There's a phenomenon which is, again, not understood. You lose weight despite eating enough calories. And then...
And that's specific to altitude, or is that just the workload?
Well, it seems to be an altitude effect.
Okay.
Several of the... it was a British organized expedition, and several of the British investigators told me the same thing. They, many of them had spent several weeks at base camp, in fact, not in fact doing very much hard work, but nevertheless eating plenty and losing weight at the same time.
Well, there you go. You start putting weight loss camps up on up a base camp on Everest then.
Yeah, yeah.
Weight loss clinics. Yeah, that's really interesting. So then... one thing that I'm actually just personally interested in, when it comes to field studies, whenever we've brought our tools of the trade into the field, whether it's deep divers or free divers or, anybody kind of with that exploration mindset, there's always a lot of interest that's piqued with respect to what you're studying and what you're looking at. Did you find the same thing with the climbing community? Were they interested in what you guys were doing and trying to get feedback as far as like the studies that you guys were running?
Oh, absolutely. And the British group actually had a full-blown lab at Namche, which is at about 12,000 feet, and another one at base camp. And they were actually doing muscle biopsies and exercise tests and,
wow.
and all kinds of things. Those data are still being crunched.
Mm-hmm.
And we look forward to those results along the way, but you're absolutely right. Yes, the climbing community is fascinated by it. The climbing community, in many ways, is like the diving community. They, it's a very elite group of people who are, everyone's got their own theory on how to do it and how best to prepare for it. But there's a relative lack of science because the experimental conditions are so tough.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. So, Dr. Moon, thank you so much for joining us today on STEM Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been great.
STEM Talk.
Wow, it's always great fun and a learning experience to talk with Dr. Moon.
Agreed. He is a broad and fascinating fellow. It's great that you had a chance to interview one of your former mentors.
Absolutely. I invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage where one can find the show notes for this episode and learn more about Dr. Moon and his important research at stemtalk.us. This is Dawn Carnegie signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until next time.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.